This is 10 Minutes or Less, a weekly-ish podcast of The Local Church. I'm Brent Levy. It was Good Friday in Birmingham, Alabama, April 12th, 1963. Just days before Easter Sunday, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and dozens of other protesters and civil rights leaders were imprisoned that day for demonstrating in the streets en masse. They were there in Birmingham to call attention to the injustice and the violence against African Americans in one of the most segregated cities in the country. On that day, April 12th, while sitting in his prison cell, the Reverend Dr. King was given a copy of the local newspaper, the Birmingham News, and in that newspaper, there was a full-page ad that featured an open letter written by 8 Jewish and Christian leaders, faith leaders, bishops and pastors and rabbis, who all called Alabama home. Their open letter urged patience and restraint among those who had been waiting their whole lives to claim their God-given rights. It called for unity, which was much easier for them to do as they enjoyed their seat of privilege. The clergymen criticized the protests and demonstrations as unwise and untimely, referring to the Reverend Dr. King and others as outsiders and extremists who sought to simply agitate and disrupt. They implored Dr. King and the demonstrators to be civil, to, quote, observe the principles of law and order, and to work out their case in the legal system, where the deck was, and in many ways still is, stacked against them simply because of the color of their skin. The Reverend Dr. King sat in his jail cell and read this letter, and he prayed. And in the margins of the newsprint, in the blank space that surrounded the words of these white clergymen, Dr. King, the Reverend Dr. King, pastor, started to write. 4 days and 7,000 words later, on April 16th, 1963, the Reverend Dr. King's margin notes and jumbled writings on scratch paper found their way to daylight by way of one of King's lawyers, who handed it off to a pastor friend who, along with his secretary, got to work decoding and collecting and editing and typing it all into one document that we now know as the letter from Birmingham Jail. This letter was addressed to those white clergymen, but the Reverend Dr. King had a much wider audience in mind. He knew what he was doing. The letter from Birmingham Jail was first published as a pamphlet, circulated in cities and towns where the civil rights movement was doing hard, holy work, and then a few months later, it found its way to other publications, and readership grew, and it would be hard to not compare Dr. King's prophetic prose to another figure in Christian history, the Apostle Paul, who also wrote a pastoral epistle from the confines of a prison cell. On this weekend, in which we celebrate and remember the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., perhaps you'll scroll through uplifting quotations on your Facebook feed or see rousing, soul-stirring clips of King's I Have a Dream speech from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. But it's also important, I think, to return to the sobering and convicting words of the letter from Birmingham Jail. As people of faith, and as the local church, as a people called to boldly stand for justice and peace for all people, by God's grace working for the day with hands, feet, heart, and voice, when justice shall roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream, seeking the day when all belong, when all are one, when the world is at last as it should be, it's important to return to these words from this letter from a Birmingham jail written in April of 1963. So here, now, in a little more than 10 minutes, is the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. reading portions of his letter. If you're interested in hearing or reading the letter in its entirety, we'll post the full text and audio in the show notes. Wherever you find yourself today, now, in this moment, whether you're in your car or at the gym, commuting or in between meetings, out for a walk, or settling in for what you thought would be a relaxing evening. Whatever it is, may these words, as they have for me, convict you, unsettle you, inspire you, and fill you with the grace you need to love where you are.
My dear fellow clergyman, while confined here in the Birmingham City Jail, I came across your recent statement calling my present activities unwise and untimely. I'm in Birmingham because injustice is here. Just as the prophets of the 8th century B.C. left their villages and carried their thus saith the Lord far beyond the boundaries of their hometowns, and just as the Apostle Paul left his village of Tarsus and carried the gospel of Jesus Christ to the far corners of the Greco-Roman world, so am I compelled to carry the gospel of freedom beyond my own hometown. Moreover, I am cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Frankly, I have yet to engage in a direct action campaign that was well timed in the view of those who have not suffered unduly from the disease of segregation. For years now, I have heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never. We must come to see with one of our distinguished jurists that justice too long delayed is justice denied. Perhaps it is easy for those who have never felt the sting dots of segregation to say wait. But when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your sisters and brothers at whim, when you have seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters, when you see the vast majority of your 20 million Negro brothers smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society, when you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park that has just been advertised on television and see tears welling up in her eyes when she is told that Funtown is closed to colored children, and see ominous clouds of inferiority beginning to form in her little mental sky, and see her beginning to distort her personality by developing an unconscious bitterness toward white people. When you have to concoct an answer for a five-year-old son who is asking, "Daddy, why do white people treat colored people so mean?" When you take a cross-country drive and find it necessary to sleep night after night in the uncomfortable corners of your automobile because no motel will accept you, when you are humiliated day in and day out by nagging signs reading white and colored, when your first name becomes nigger, your middle name becomes boy, however old you are, and your last name becomes John, and your wife and mother are never given the respected title Mrs., when you are harried by day and haunted by night by the fact that you are a Negro, living constantly at tiptoe stands, never quite knowing what to expect next, and are plagued with inner fears and outer resentments, when you are forever fighting a degrading and degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait. There comes a time when the cup of endurance runs over, and men are no longer willing to be plunged into the abyss of despair. I hope, sirs, you can understand our legitimate and unavoidable impatience. I must make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you and the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action, who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by a mythical concept of time, and who constantly advises a Negro to wait for a more convenient season. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. But though I was initially disappointed at being categorized as an extremist, as I continued to think about the matter, I gradually gained a measure of satisfaction from the label. Was not Jesus an extremist for love? Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Was not Amos an extremist for justice? Let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like a mighty stream. Was not Paul an extremist for the Christian gospel? I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus Christ. Was not Martin Luther an extremist? Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, so help me God. Was not John Bunyan an extremist? I will stay in jail to the end of my days before I make a butchery of my conscience. And Abraham Lincoln, this nation cannot survive half slave and half free. And Thomas Jefferson, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. So the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be. Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice? In that dramatic scene on Calvary's Hill, three men were crucified. We must never forget that all three were crucified for the same crime, the crime of extremism. Two were extremists for immorality, and thus fell below that environment. The other, Jesus Christ, was an extremist for love, truth, and goodness, and thereby rose above his environment. Perhaps the South, the nation, and the world are in dire need of creative extremists. Let me take note of my other major disappointment. I have been so greatly disappointed with the white church and its leadership. Of course, there are some notable exceptions, and I'm not unmindful of these. But despite these notable exceptions, I must honestly reiterate that I have been disappointed with the church. I do not say this as one of those negative critics who can always find something wrong with the church. I say this as a minister of the gospel who loves the church, who was nurtured in its bosom, who has been sustained by its spiritual blessings, and who will remain true to it as long as the cords of life shall lengthen. When I was suddenly catapulted into the leadership of the bus protest in Montgomery, Alabama a few years ago, I felt we would be supported by the white church. But this never came through. All too many ministers found themselves more cautious than courageous and remained silent behind the safe security of stained glass windows. I have traveled the length and breadth of Alabama, Mississippi, and all the other southern states on sweltering summer days and crisp autumn mornings. I have looked at the South's beautiful churches with their lofty spires pointing heavenward. I have beheld the impressive outlines of a massive religious education buildings. Over and over, I have found myself asking, what kind of people worship here? Who is their God? Where were their voices when the lips of Governor Bonnet dripped with words of interposition and nullification? Where were they when Governor Wallace gave a clarion call for defiance and hatred? Where were their voices of support when bruised and weary Negro men and women decided to rise from the dark dungeons of complacency to the bright hills of creative protest? There was a time when the church was very powerful, and the time when the early Christians rejoiced at being deemed worthy to suffer for what they believe. In those days, the church was not merely a thermometer that recorded the ideas and principles of popular opinion. It was a thermostat that transformed the mores of society. Whenever the early Christians entered a town, the people in power became disturbed and immediately sought to convict the Christians for being disturbers of the peace and outside agitators. But the Christians pressed on in the conviction that they were a colony of heaven, called by God to obey God rather than man. Small in number, they were big in commitment. They were too God-intoxicated to be astronomically intimidated. Things are different now. So often the contemporary church is a weak, ineffectual voice with an uncertain sound. But the judgment of God is upon the church as never before. If today's church does not recapture the sacrificial spirit of the early church, it will lose its authentic ring and forfeit the loyalty of millions and be dismissed as an irrelevant social club with no meaning for the 20th century. Perhaps I have once again been too optimistic. Is organized religion too inextricably bound to the status quo to save our nation and world? Never before have I written so long a letter. I'm afraid it is much too long to take your precious time. I can assure you that it would have been much shorter if I had been writing from a comfortable desk. But what else can one do when he is alone in a narrow jail cell other than write long letters, think long thoughts, and pray long prayers? If I have said anything in this letter that overstates the truth and indicates an unreasonable impatience, I beg you to forgive me. If I have said anything that understates the truth and indicates my having a patience that allows me to settle for anything less than brotherhood, I beg God to forgive me. I hope this letter finds you strong in the faith. I also hope that circumstances will soon make it possible for me to meet each of you, not as an integrationist or as a civil rights leader, But as a fellow clergyman and a Christian brother, let us all hope that the dark clouds of racial prejudice will soon pass away and the deep fog of misunderstanding will be lifted from our fear-drenched communities. And in some not too distant tomorrow, the radiant stars of love and brotherhood will shine over our great nation with all their scintillating beauty. Yours for the cause of peace and brotherhood, Martin Luther King, Jr.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome.
Minutes or Less is a podcast of the local church, a bold, inclusive, new faith community committed to being with and for one another, our community, and the world. You'll find us in bold purple throughout Chatham County, North Carolina, but we are a new expression of Christ United Methodist Church in Chapel Hill. If you love what you hear, share this episode with a friend or a family member or a neighbor or a stranger, anybody who could use a little inspiration, a little bit of love. Ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts are always a big help, too. And we can't do this without your generous support. If you believe that this is making a difference in your week or adding value to your life, consider making a donation to help offset the cost of this podcast and invest in the greater work that God's doing through the local church. We can't do it without you, and you can do it online. Just visit thelocalchurchpbo.org and select Give. Wes Frady keeps the show alive each week, giving me deadlines and producing the podcast. There are so many weeks you wouldn't have a show if not for him. My email is in the show notes if you want to connect with me to learn more about what God's up to through the local church. And we're easy to find on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram too. Just search for The Local Church or Local Church PBO, all one word. Local tables have begun throughout Chatham County. It's where the magic happens, complete with authentic connection, meaningful conversation, and a really good meal. All the info is on our website for you to find yours. Thanks for making space in your week for this podcast, friends. Remember, you're not alone, and love where you are.